according to a global analysis of genomic surveillance. But the study also found that despite these challenges, countries have become faster at sharing sequences over the course of the pandemic. Openly sharing genome sequencing data from SARS-CoV-2 samples has allowed researchers to track how the virus is evolving and has become a hallmark of the pandemic. But researchers are concerned that data gaps could make it harder to spot the next COVID-19 variant of concern and could frustrate efforts to respond to it quickly. Nilika Malavic, an immunologist at the University of Sri Jayapundra in Colombo, said sharing data is absolutely important for everybody's survival. In the study published in the Nature Genetics recently, researchers collected genomic data uploaded to public repositories, including GISAID, between the beginning of the pandemic and October 31, 2021. Comprising roughly 4.9 million genomes from 169 countries. They compared those sequences with official reports from individual countries and found that 62 countries that report those data, 23 more than one-third, had uploaded fewer than 50% of their sequences from the variants of concern Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta. About one quarter of countries had uploaded fewer than 25% of their sequences. The lack of sharing is a global problem, says co-author Andrew Asman, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, adding, "It's not just a rich or poor country thing." The authors suggest several reasons that some countries might not share all their sequences on public repositories. It's possible that some of the samples were not sequenced in the first place because they are ways of identifying variants of concern without sequencing the full genomes, says Asman. And depending on the sequencing technology that researchers have used, some samples were probably not of sufficient quality to upload, explains Cynthia Saloma, a molecular biologist at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City. But a chunk of unshared sequences are probably being held back for political reasons, including the repercussions of being the first country to report a new variant of concern. Most countries that share those data usually are made to suffer for it, says Nedodo, a molecular bioengineer at the Nigeria Center for Disease Control in Abuja. For example, when researchers in South Africa and Botswana alerted the world to the Omicron variant last November, a slew of countries responded by shutting their borders to the region. In some countries, governments need to review and approve sequences before they are uploaded. Governments of tourism-dependent nations might ask their labs not to share the data because of the impact it will have, said Malavic. But Asman says data sharing is only part of the story. Some countries share a high proportion of their samples, but have sequenced only a handful of genomes, he says. The researchers found that 87 countries were routinely sequencing samples, but 31 were not. And the team couldn't find information about the genomic surveillance strategies for another 76. Globally, no more than 4.5% of confirmed COVID-19 cases were sequenced every week from September 2020 onwards, with large discrepancies across regions, from a total of 3.4% genomes sequenced in Europe during the study period to 0.1% in the Eastern Mediterranean. Some countries, including Norway, the UK, and Canada, have sequenced at least 10% of their cumulative cases. The study also assessed the quality of metadata uploaded to GISAID by 169 countries. It found that 63% of sequences did not include information about the age and sex of the person they were sampled from, and more than 95% were missing clinical information such as symptom severity and the vaccination status of the infected person. Higher-income countries tended to provide fewer metadata than did lower-income regions. Metadata are especially important when a new variant emerges to assess who is most at risk, how well existing vaccines and drugs will work, and the conditions that could have led to its emergence, says researchers. Again, there could be many reasons for the information gaps, such as data privacy concerns and that the collection of metadata can't keep up with the pace of samples being sequenced. Sometimes a sample might be missing metadata but have come from a remote province, making it too precious not to share, says Nino Susanto, a bioengineer who heads the COVID-19 testing lab, GSI Lab in Jakarta. Despite data sharing challenges, the study also found that countries have become faster at sharing sequences during the pandemic. In 2020, it took close to 3 months on average for researchers in most countries to collect, sequence, and upload genomic data to public repositories. However, that fell to 20 days by the time the Delta variant emerged in 2021. As Van says, this pandemic has normalized sharing.
NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was established in 1949 to organize political and military support between the United States and a group of European nations in order to deter and, if necessary, defeat the Soviet Union. After the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO gradually morphed into an instrument through which the capitalist class of North America and Europe seeks to impose its political will on the rest of the world, mostly via military operations.
I've come here to express the United States' steadfast commitment to that alliance, which has been the cornerstone of peace, prosperity, stability for the transatlantic community for more than 70 years.
Over the past decades, the organization has waged wars on a number of countries, all in the name of democracy and peace, most of them both illegal and unsuccessful. Libya and the 2011 NATO intervention there have become synonymous with failure and disaster. The intervention didn't produce anything resembling a stable democracy. Instead, it led to utter chaos, violence, instability, and civil war.
I cannot be sure there have been no civilian casualties. What I can be sure of is that we are very, very precise and discriminate in our targeting. There have been more instances than I can think of in the conduct of this campaign where our pilots have made the correct decision to not attack a legitimate military target for concern of the civilian casualties that that attack would have caused. It is a very, very high priority, and I cannot emphasize enough the precision with which we conduct these strikes.
While political entities in the West were quick to celebrate the intervention in Libya as a success, the NATO campaign caused many civilian deaths and destroyed the nation's infrastructure. Moreover, the following instability unleashed an array of militias and terrorist groups that put the whole region in danger. As for Libya, NATO has failed in yet another sense. Tensions between Turkey and France as two state members of NATO over supporting different sides in Libya is a case in point.
In Libya, we are supporting the legitimate government, and the French government is supporting an illegitimate warlord and jeopardizing, as I said, NATO security, Mediterranean security, North African security, Libya's political stability. And I'm giving all this. They still blame us. They still criticize us.
Meanwhile, France considers Turkey as a non-conformist member of NATO. But Libya is not the only debacle in the recent history of NATO. After an easy military campaign in 2001 that drove the Taliban from power, ensuring stability and rebuilding Afghanistan's political and economic foundation proved challenging tasks for the transatlantic community. Despite having tens of thousands of soldiers from member countries of NATO and Afghanistan for two decades, the Taliban finally took over the country, another blow to the so-called biggest military alliance in the world.
When we made the decision, we all knew the risks. We all knew that entailed risks, also the risk of Taliban returning, though no one anticipated that this should happen so fast, the rapid return of Taliban. But we also knew that the alternative to end our military presence also entailed risks.
NATO's European members did not anticipate that involvement in Afghanistan would be a long war. The European members thought it would be a low-cost demonstration of solidarity and sympathy with American people, rather than a protracted operational commitment. According to one assessment, European politicians declared that Afghanistan was vital to their own security, but in practice continued to treat it as an American responsibility. In the context of a faltering campaign, the upshot was evaporating public support and mutual transatlantic disillusionment. Despite a two-decade occupation, NATO failed to bring peace and security to Afghanistan. A few months ago, the British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace pointed out that NATO was a political failure in Afghanistan. While NATO claims to be promoting peace across the world, the recent case of Ukraine reveals the opposite. By poking Russia through its expansionism, NATO is certainly more than an innocent bystander in the current Ukraine-Russia escalation. Not only has the organization failed in promoting peace, NATO has almost been standing by and doing nothing in the wake of this conflict, a stab in the back for the Ukrainians. In late February, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused NATO and the European Union of failing to take a determined stance on the Russian attack on Ukraine. The fact is, NATO's response to Russia's current actions does not mirror its response to Russia during the Cold War. The inaction has prompted Kyiv to reconsider its attempt to join NATO. This hesitation to get directly involved in the Ukraine-Russia conflict comes after a series of defeats NATO suffered in Afghanistan and Libya. It seems that the organization is unable to fulfill even its original mission, i.e., to deter the Russian bear.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The one-day Negev summit was a stab in the back of the Palestinian people who denounced it as a betrayal. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by the staff of Crescent International. This article is published under the heading Treacherous Arabian Rulers Embrace Zionist Israel in the Summit of Shamelessness. Here's more. Foreign ministers of four Arabian regimes met with the Zionist regime foreign minister, Yair Lapid, under the watchful eye of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on March 28. It was dubbed a security summit and held in the Zionist-occupied Negev. Lapid was quite candid in describing what the purpose of the so-called summit was. Lapid said, "What we are doing here is making history. Building a new regional architecture based on progress, technology, religious tolerance, security and intelligence cooperation." He also claimed, "This new architecture and shared capabilities we are building intimidates and deters our common enemies." Religious tolerance is a buzzword for acceptance of the preeminence of the Zionist entity that falsely claims to represent the Jewish people. The vast majority of Jews worldwide refuse to accept Israel as representing their view, much less being their homeland. The Saudi regime continues to hover in the background. Its de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, or as he is called, MBS, is on record as saying that Israel is not an enemy but a potential ally. MBS is using the UAE and Bahrain as stalking horses for his own surrender to the Zionists. The one-day Negev summit was a stab in the back of the Palestinian people who denounced it as a betrayal. And betrayal it was, since the Zionist regime and its heavily armed thugs continue to brutalize the Palestinian people. Only 4 days earlier, the UN Special Rapporteur in Palestine, Michael Link, had issued a devastating report about the Zionist regime's crimes against the Palestinian people. Professor Link's report concluded that Israel is practicing apartheid against the Palestinian people in occupied Palestine. The UN report follows on the publication of similar findings of the Zionist regime's apartheid by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, an Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, Yesh Din, and many other international and regional human rights organizations. Surely, the Arabian dinosaurs could not be the oblivious of these reports. So why do they continue to normalize relations with the Zionist monstrosity that has brutalized the Palestinian people, including women and children, for decades? Being unrepresentative regimes, they need some protective power for survival. With the U.S. role shrinking in the West Asia-North Africa region, not because it has realized the error of its ways, but due to successive defeats it has suffered, these Arabian regimes are looking for other protectors. What they fail to realize is that the only guaranteed protection is provided by none other than God. These rulers may be Muslim in the name, but not in practice. They have more faith in the Zionist regime's weapons and intelligence, despite the Zionist regime itself being a temporary phenomenon, shows their fickle nature. The Zionist entity will not be able to save them from collapse. Artificial summits and other gimmicks will prove useless when the crunch comes.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Now, the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict and the associated sanctions have already had a severe impact on the global economy, creating an adverse shock to inflation and economic activity at a time when fuel prices in particular were already high. Meanwhile, the sanctions have also had a substantial impact on global financial markets, with significant slipovers to other countries. To make matters even worse for Europe, now Russia is demanding what it calls unfriendly countries to pay for Russian gas in rubles. It appears that the West will be facing great difficulty, which it will not be able to circumvent. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the impact of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, particularly on EU economy. But first, let's get an update from our correspondent, in Brussels.
That's right. Well, there's no doubt it would be impossible to overstate the impact that this conflict is having on the economy of the European Union. I mean, there are many fronts to this, but when you look at energy prices alone, as you mentioned in the introduction, they were already very high before the conflict, and now they're being pushed up through the roof. It's unbelievable, actually, for EU citizens, and we're only seeing the start of it, according to the analysts that I've been speaking to, because you know, when you have a situation whereby companies are filling their container loads of goods, essential items to be travelled across the European Union, the diesel prices have gone very, very high, and those costs have to be passed on to the consumer. So it's not just an ordinary household who's filling their small car with petrol or diesel or even an electric car. It's actually other goods as well that are hitting citizens. Citizens were already hard-pressed before this. And as I say, according to the analysts I've been speaking to, it's going to get much worse because there's no end in sight. And you have to ask the question, how could have this been avoided? Is this a failure of diplomacy from Western leaders in terms of, you know, we saw this coming down the tracks. We have the Russian Federation now accusing the EU of actually breaking laws because they're actually picking out Russian individuals and applying sanctions and releasing their personal data, which the Russian Federation, the foreign ministry, says goes against all international norms. And also, you have two other elements of this, which is very, very crucial to EU citizens. They're very concerned. They're saying that, you know, it's not only the prices, inflation is very high, which means the cost of living is very, very high indeed. But you also have the refugee crisis. Of course, we have great sympathy for the Ukrainians that have been deeply impacted by this crisis, those displaced within the country, but also fleeing the European Union. But again, there's huge costs associated with trying to accommodate these refugees. And then the backdrop to all of this is great concern about how it might escalate. Could this escalate further? We see now when Russia is saying that the gas must be paid for in rubles, the energy must be paid for in rubles. How could it escalate? Could it be a situation that Russia turns off the taps altogether, which could create an untold economic crisis to the European Union? Germany alone gets 50% of the energy, the gas it uses, comes from Russia. So it's the economic powerhouse of the European Union. It's only one country, but it's such a significant country, you know, economically. So you have to wonder, how could this escalate? All the while, EU citizens are being hurt. And of course, if you speak to energy experts, they say Russia is a net exporter of energy, not Russia, the United States. And therefore, of course, the impact on the United States is going to be much less. Of course, citizens in America will feel this as well, but not as much as EU citizens. So therefore, the critics who say that NATO foreign policy and EU foreign policy has been driven by Washington, and then Washington stands back and doesn't take all the impact of this, then you have to ask a lot of questions about the EU's autonomy and how it goes forward in terms of its future foreign policy decisions.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, live from Brussels. And now to continue our discussion, we are joined by Carly Shangler, spokesman of the LaRouche organization, who is joining us live from Germany, and also Paolo Raffone, secretary general of the CIPI Foundation, live from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with Mr. Raffone. Now, Russia is insisting on receiving gas payments from European countries that it calls unfriendly and rubles. And at this stage, Europeans have pointed out that this goes against the contracts. To what extent do you think that this currency switch is, first of all, justified, and in the wake of the sanctions imposed of Russia, would it be actually possible to do that?
Well, let's start to say that after imposing unilaterally sanctions on the Central Bank of Russia, it was normal and reasonable to expect a reaction. Well, the reaction has come, and it is, you need my gas, you pay it in my currency. And so this is absolutely a normal reaction, I would say, even quite mild, because they are not telling us we just close the tap. The reaction of the EU has been hysterical, as usual, in the past weeks, with a number of declarations saying that it is not contractual or that cannot be fulfilled and so on. Well, no rubles, no gas. That's the point Putin has made, which makes to me quite sense in the situation we are living today. What will happen, I do not know. There will be a compromise on either side, I do not know. Certainly what I see is that there is no strategy on the European side. There is no strategy at all to handle the effects of this crisis, which are in good part self-imposed through these extensive sanctions that have been imposed on Russia. And in terms of national countries in the EU, they are also completely lost. They just try to adopt some emergency measures like Germany or Austria. But in the case of Italy, for instance, there is nothing. There is just words. And Italy is depending for 47% of gas import from Russia. So it is a very complicated and sad situation. I do not see very easy way out without becoming reasonable on both sides.
Okay, so Mr. Shengler, how much do you think this retaliatory move by Moscow would be effective?
Well, I find it quite insulting for the EU and the U.S. to say the Russians are breaking the contract by demanding rubles when sanctions, in a sense, are breaking a contract. The policy is entirely the fault of Washington and the European Union. They refuse to negotiate with the Russians on Putin's reasonable security demands, and then they loaded up sanctions and literally are running an economic warfare operation against Russia. So what Putin did was a very simple and straightforward measure. He said, if you want our, you have to pay in rubles. Now, it's not so difficult for European governments or companies to go to the Moscow bank, the Gazprom bank, for example, and buy rubles. They're just trying to punish Russia. And this is why I've been saying it's economic warfare against Russia, which is the intent of the whole situation of NATO pouring arms into Ukraine to use Ukraine as a weapon against Russia. And the issue here is that the Russians are working on new agreements with China. They're working on new agreements with India, a ruble for rupee trade arrangement. We're moving into a whole new economic universe, and the West is terrified about it. The Anglo-Americans won't accept it, and that's why they're trying to degrade and destroy the Russian economy.
So, Mr. Raffone, Russia has officially announced that from April the 1st, which is the deadline, it will be receiving those payments in rubles. And Europeans so far have not complied. Do you think that they eventually will?
I am not in the mind of either side, but I think that it would be reasonable if Russia will stick to its words and impose the fact that the national currency for the settlement is used. By the way, Europeans may be using the system of payment which Russia and China and the rest of the BRICS have put into place, and pay the gas through that system of payment. There is nothing against it. There is no law that forbids doing this. So it's enough not to pay it in dollars through the SWIFT system, but to move through the alternative system created by the BRICS, which, by the way, is a viable system because the total of GDP of the BRICS is about 43% of the world GDP, while the US and EU summed together is about 36%. So I do not see what's the problem. They want to be paid in their currency, fair enough. We cannot use the SWIFT system because we have imposed sanctions on Russia. Fair enough, we use another system. The problem is how to explain this to Mr. Biden.
Okay, so Mr. Shengler, how do you think Russia's new approach will affect the dollar? You just said that we are looking at a whole new world now. Are you expecting these recent developments to lead to a shift in international commerce by reinforcing an anti-dollar axis?
Well, I think it already has started. The ruble fell to 139 rubles to the dollar when the sanctions were first imposed. Now it's back to the pre-war level of about 80 or 82 to the dollar. So the ruble has recovered. Meanwhile, you have China and Saudi Arabia talking about the Saudis accepting or making their payments for the Chinese payments in yuan to the Saudis. There, as I mentioned, the Indians and the Russians have an agreement. Sergei Lavrov is in New Delhi today to discuss this. This is something that had to happen because the inflation started before anything happened in Ukraine. The inflation in the West is based on the efforts to bail out a failing financial system with free money, with no interest money to the speculators, to the banks, the hedge funds. And when you pump $13 trillion into an economy, even a big economy like the U.S. in a short time, it has an effect on the dollar. So the dollar has been seriously weakened. I think the other thing is that why would countries want to hold their reserves in dollars if the U.S. threatens to seize them the way it did $300 billion of Russian sovereign fund? So I think this is sending a signal that certainly Biden didn't expect, which is you can't trust the United States. And I think it's very clear for countries like Venezuela, Nigeria, Algeria, Indonesia, Iran, and other countries that have been the recipient of sanctions and nasty economic policies from the United States to look elsewhere. It's just that this is the first time now between the Russian and the Chinese February 4th agreement that you have strong enough nations that can stand up to the dollar and NATO.
Well, thank you. And exactly in line with your explanations, the IMF has said that sanctions on Russia could erode the dominance of the U.S. dollar and spur the adoption of digital currencies. So, Mr. Raffone, do you believe that this could actually happen?
Yes, I think, well, it's not if it happens. It is already happening because finally the clearing system that has been put into place with the BRICS is using the EU1 as a facilitator for the exchanges. So the EU1 is a sort of a cryptocurrency, but is a state cryptocurrency, which in the case of the exchanges in the BRICS system is guaranteed also by very large natural resources, which are backing the value of the EU1. And the technology innovation that China and other countries can provide is a stimulus for the appreciation of this currency. So this is a very different type of cryptocurrency. We have to look at it because it's a state cryptocurrency. It's not a cryptocurrency of Mr. Munsk or some other private entrepreneur. And this changes completely the Bretton Woods setup, and the Americans probably thought that they could continue bombing people to impose their dollar. Well, I would start calming down and sit down and accept a multilateral way of thinking instead of a unilateral bombing system.
Oh, very good. So, Mr. Shangler, in the meantime, U.S. has been trying to affect the oil prices by releasing 1 million barrels of oil every day. How effective do you think this increase in oil production could be, and would it be able to alleviate the situation considering the fact that OPEC Plus is not on board totally?
I don't think it'll have much of an effect. I think it shows that President Biden is getting terrible economic advice. But I want to make a comment on what my colleague just said, which is extremely important, because the problem with the dollar is it's backed by nothing. Since 1971, when they took the dollar off a gold reserve standard, it's been based on the economic power of the United States, but that power has been eroded. We're seeing a shift in the world toward Asia, and he mentioned the technology. It's also the raw materials. The ruble now is backed by oil, it's backed by nitrogen, it's backed by fertilizer, by lumber, by strategic metals. The dollar is backed by nothing but promises from the United States, which they're not keeping. So I think when Biden thinks he's going to solve the problem of Americans complaining about high gas prices at the pump by releasing 1 million barrels a day, he's dreaming. It's not going to solve it. Unless there's a global agreement, which has to come through OPEC, and that includes Russia in the equation, unless that happens, the United States and Europe are going to have trouble. Look, I live in Germany. We're being told to expect gas rationing at some point in the very near future. We're also being told that there will be blackouts and they're going to have to withhold electricity from industrial firms in order to keep the lights on in family homes. So the Germans decided to go along with NATO, and now the German people are going to end up paying a price for that.
So do you believe that we should be looking at prices above $200 a barrel?
I'm not sure because, as you know, the prices are always affected by the Rotterdam spot market and speculators, and the prices jump up before the supply shuts down. I think this is where we see the potential to take the power away from the speculators and put it in the hands of the producers.
Thank you. And our last question is for Mr. Raffone. What other options do Europeans have? Do they have any other options?
Well, at this stage, they have very little options. They have been entering what in French is called a cul-de-sac, so in no way, no exit option that they have self-inflicted to themselves. They could have, if they would have been able, but they have not, they could have done something, which was to say, well, Europe, the continental Europe is the real West. The UK and the US are not the real West. So we reclaim our role and we restart a multilateral relation with the rest of the world in spite of the US-UK position. But unfortunately, this didn't happen, and I do not see how, with the leaderships we have in Europe, anything may happen better what they have done, which is quite dreadful.
Okay, and Mr. Shangler, do you have any final comments regarding this last question, the options that Europeans have right now?
I think what my colleague just said is absolutely right. Stop listening to the U.S. and the British. If you want to solve this problem, stop arming Ukraine. Stop encouraging them to fight and get an agreement.
Thank you very much. And now that was Mr. Harley Shangler, spokesman of the LaRouche organization from Germany. And we also had with us Pablo Raffone, Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, live from Brussels. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And thanks to all of you for following us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Failing to fund the global fight against COVID-19 is a choice to extend the pandemic, said one public health expert. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden wants to give 163 times more to U.S. military than to global pandemic response. Here's the story. One day after President Joe Biden asked Congress to approve a record-shattering $813 billion U.S. military budget, public health advocates are lamenting that his fiscal year 2023 spending blueprint requests roughly 163 times less funding to help mitigate the COVID-19 pandemic on a global scale. The defense budget request is $813 billion. By comparison, the White House has asked for just $5 billion to fight global COVID, or $22.5 billion to fight COVID in total. Peter May Barduk, director of Public Citizens Access to Medicines Program, said in a statement recently, adding, that's roughly 3% of defense spending to help end a pandemic that has taken more American lives than any war, and nearly 20 million lives worldwide so far, referring to estimates of excess mortality. Lindsay Kashigarian, director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, said in a statement recently that $813 billion, the president's request for the Pentagon, exceeds even the $782 billion budget that Congress just passed by $31 billion. The increase alone is twice the amount that Congress refused for ongoing COVID aid for antivirals, vaccines, and tests after nearly 1 million Americans have died of the virus. Earlier this month, as Common Dreams reported, Democratic congressional leaders removed $15.6 billion in coronavirus relief from a recently passed $1.5 billion omnibus spending bill after Republican lawmakers, questioning the need for any new funding to fight the pandemic, insisted on repurposing money already allocated to state programs. Democratic lawmakers are reportedly trying to find a way to pass a coronavirus aid package separately. In the meantime, however, the defunding of the U.S. pandemic response, which the GOP spearheaded as infectious caused by an Omicron subvariant surged in Europe and Asia, sparking fears of an imminent wave at home, has led to what one physician called the rationing of COVID care by ability to pay. Last week, a federal health agency tasked with covering COVID-19 testing and treatment for uninsured people in the U.S. stopped accepting claims, and those patients will now be charged $125 for a single PCR test. On the global front, May Barduk warned that without emergency funding, vaccines will expire on shelves in countries where they are needed most. The extraordinary efforts of scientists, health workers, and activists worldwide to develop, manufacture, and distribute life-saving medicine against COVID will falter for want of the least we could ask of governments. As lawmakers discuss Biden's funding request for the domestic and international pandemic response, May Barduk pointed out that health experts called for $17 billion from Congress to resource the global fight, emphasizing that $5 billion is the bare minimum needed to prevent global vaccination testing and emergency relief from screeching to halt. In a recent report documenting the harmful economic impacts of global vaccine inequity on informal workers and other vulnerable populations in low-income countries, the United Nations estimated that it would cost just $18 billion to vaccinate 70% of the world's population by mid-2022. Public Citizen, for its part, has developed a blueprint showing how the U.S., with a $25 billion investment, could establish regional manufacturing hubs to produce 8 billion life-saving doses in less than a year. Ending the pandemic is a choice, said May Bardugh, adding Congress must step up and pass funds to support the White House's already pared back request. Failing to fund the global fight against COVID-19 is a choice to extend the pandemic, to accept preventable suffering and insecurity for all, and to live with the knowledge that deep in the time of the world's greatest need, the United States gave up. Robert Weisman, president of Public Citizen, wrote recently on social media that as elected officials race toward a $1 trillion Pentagon budget, this shameful spending makes the U.S. less secure. Washington, he warned, will be more likely to engage in warfare and no more able to address pandemics or climate chaos. According to Stephen Semler of the Security Policy Reform Institute, Biden's budget request is tantamount to climate change denialism. Semler found that despite mentioning some version of tackling the climate crisis nearly a dozen times in his proposal, the president wants to spend 18 times more on the U.S. military-industrial complex, a bigger polluter than 171 countries, than he does on a slashing greenhouse gas emissions. Khashoggian, meanwhile, noted that the U.S. military budget is already more than the next 11 countries combined, 12 times more than Russia's and higher than at the peak of Vietnam War or the Cold War. She added, if more militarism were the key to a stable and secure world, we would already be there.